and the decisions we make in this moment,
where we were almost
stay hungry, that, stay foolish.
We were becoming
right.
Something greater.
So awesome. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Okay, so we had a few questions. I wanted to ask you two before we get too deep into it. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your specialty? Because I know obviously you from our leadership class, and so that's where my mind goes, but I'm not sure if that's correct.
Yeah, absolutely. My specialty is leadership. So I recently developed a required class here at the Huntsman School that helps students understand their leadership and develop their leadership capabilities. I also do leadership research that seeks to understand how to bring out the best in leaders and how leaders can unleash the talent in others.
That's really awesome. So I had no idea you actually helped develop the whole class and program here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Is that like a long process? Is that a lot of politics? Is it easy?
Yeah, it could go either way. I've known classes that have been pretty weighed down in a lot of bureaucratic decision making. This one, they gave me free autonomy to pick and choose what the content was, how I delivered it. And so essentially I just went and looked at what the best schools were doing. So I got syllabus from Stanford, from University of Virginia, from Boston, from a number of different schools, and found out that there was really a common element to them, and that was around helping students become more self-aware about their own individual leadership, helping them understand that leadership is within their grasp, and then giving them opportunities to actually practice leadership principles so that they could develop their leadership skills in a hands-on and experiential way.
Wow, that is really cool. I don't mean to digress because I kind of wanted to get into some more preliminary questions, but like how long has leadership been taught? How long has this been a program in schools, do you know?
So it's been a class for a number of years, even before I came here, which was about a year and a half ago. It's now just a required class or an acumen class, so all business majors have to take the class of the past year. And so part of this is a larger development to make leadership a cornerstone for the brand of the Huntsman School. We've always had ethical leadership as one of the four pillars, and we haven't really done a lot of work on that front to really bake that into what students experience here. So part of my mandate to come here was to develop a course and to create a leadership center that would house a number of activities that would create greater value for our students, for professionals that wanted to come back and learn about leadership, and where we could do more research to foster leadership research here and with colleagues abroad.
So what other aspects do we have in this leadership program besides the class? Like if I was a student and I wanted to get more involved in this section of the business school, what's offered, I guess?
Yeah. So there are a number of things in the works right now. The only standalone thing that we have right now is the actual required leadership class. But there are a number of different activities, different programs that are in progress that are going through the more bureaucratic process because it needs more institutional approval as opposed to just offering a class.
Okay, very cool. So we'll back up a little bit then. That was really interesting, sorry. So I was planning on getting to that later, but what do you think, maybe we'll tie it together, what do you think led you to having a desire in leadership? Maybe like as a child, like what kind of child were you? Was there something that like sparked that interest, or did it just kind of happen?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I asked my mom time to time to ask, remind me of what kind of kid I was, because you don't remember those stories. They're easily forgotten. But two stories that she generally brings to mind are both when I actually put myself and others in danger. And I was actually two at the time, and in Sandy, and my parents had left me with a babysitter and to go shopping around the Thanksgiving holiday. And they returned home that evening and found the babysitter on the phone with the police. And I had completely disappeared. Now, this is a two-year-old, walked out the front door, left. As it turns out, a neighbor had picked me up, nourished me with McDonald's and ice cream until she called the local youth detention facility, and the police actually came picked me up, and fortunately in my Cleveland Brown jacket, I don't know why I had a Cleveland Brown jacket, I had my name in it, so when my parents called around to find out where I was, they were able to connect me. The second story that she tells is when I was five and they were living in student housing, and I took five or six kids all in our tricycles, four wheelers, what have you, bikes, and led them across four different complexes. And we left without any parental supervision, crossed a road that was probably the equivalent of Main Street here in Logan. So it was very dangerous. And she thinks we were trying to get ice cream to an ice cream place. And so she attributes that to me as being a natural leader from the beginning and having interest in leading others. I think part of me is also an adventurer, someone that likes to explore, push boundaries. And so it's played out throughout my life where we have, you know, five kids in five different states. You know, instead of leading them across four different complexes, I've led them, my wife and kids, across the country to several states and had some rich experiences. And along the way, you know, I held some leadership roles and nurtured my desire to learn more about leadership.
That's really, really cool. So would you say that kind of transferred? Like, as you were getting into high school, did you get into kind of more like extreme sports? Were you finding yourself kind of going your own way or?
So it wasn't, it wasn't extreme sports. And okay. We didn't have a lot of extreme sports in Kansas. It's pretty flat. So I didn't have the luxury of, you know, snowboarding or some of the great things that we have here in Utah. But I did demonstrate leadership on the basketball team and cross country and student government. For me, leadership is about knowing who you are, standing for your principles, and having a positive influence on others. And so I think that translated a lot of things that I did in high school and in my career.
Very cool. So I kind of want to get into then, you did some consulting, could you tell us what type of consulting that was and maybe some of the companies you worked with?
Yeah. So I continue to do consulting. It's my own business, and it's affiliated with a larger enterprise that specializes in organization design and strategy. And the way I got started in this was when I was a poor PhD student at the University of Virginia. I was looking for ways to provide for a family of four, soon to be five. And I came across a gentleman who was a family friend from Kansas City that had started a boutique consulting firm, and asked him about opportunity to work with him in a part-time role. Well, within about 3 days, he'd invited me down to Lowe's, their headquarters in North Carolina, and proceeded to just dump, you know, the material upon me for, you know, a period of about 24 hours till my brain exploded, and then they turned me loose on clients, you know, shortly thereafter. And the nervous and discouraging, difficult part of this was that they had fired four consultants before me coming on from my organization. That these consultants showed up, the leaders at Lowe's didn't like them, they hadn't performed well. And so there was a lot of pressure for us to actually deliver what the client needed and put some consultants that were capable and competent. And so I remember staying up, you know, late at night trying to memorize the material, role-playing with myself, thinking about how conversations would go. And sure enough, you know, I to my surprise and probably to the surprise of the client, I exceeded their expectations and was invited back. And I worked there part-time for about 6 months during a large organizational transformation where I'd commute down there for 3 days every week as I was finishing up my PhD program. But that was my entrance into consulting. Since then, when there's a surplus of work and they need someone to come in and help, I've had a chance to work with companies like American Express, Panda Express, Danaher, General Mills, Honda. All have been, you know, amazing experiences because I love to stay connected with the real world and to apply some of the things that I'm learning as I do my research on leadership, and also get questions and data from companies that I consult with. You know, for example, American Express gave me an opportunity to collect some data, some really interesting data on coaching and how they can be more effective in their coaching techniques. And so I think it's a symbiotic or synergistic relationship between some of my outreach professional efforts and the research and teaching I do.
So was that when, so you'd go into a company, and would it be like different parts? Would part of the consulting be, okay, we're going to help with some maybe strategy and management, and then you would come in and help with management as far as like leadership skills and ways they could motivate their employees? Am I close to that, or am I pretty far off?
So it depends, but in general, that followed a typical format. They would call us in when they needed to, when they weren't executing in a way that they had hoped, and they wanted to make some type of change. And so managers typically think about, leaders typically think about, when they want to make a change, they reorganize a structure. So let's move the pieces on the board, let's put them in different positions. And what they fail to understand is that for organizations to execute effectively, there's a myriad of other choices that need to be made in order to actually execute a change. So you start off with your strategy, but then you have to identify what the capability is that's going to support that strategy. And so, so for example, Walmart's strategy is to be low cost. And their capability then that underlines, that allows them to execute that, is around distribution. They have phenomenal world-class distribution capabilities. And those capabilities don't come by accident. They come through a series of choices around who they hire, around the processes that they have, around the incentives and rewards that they put in place, around the structure that they have, around the culture. And so we help them go in, look, if you want to make this change from A to B, here are some of the choices that you need to make in order to be able to migrate to this type of execution that you're looking for. So let's consider choices that need to be different, differentiating choices that allow you to execute at a higher level in all these different disciplines that I just shared.
So there's a lot more to it than just feel good, like, yeah, we should, come on guys, we can do it kind of thing. There's a lot, it's very integrated into the system that they have. And does it ever change the system that they have? Do you ever like change the whole thing and say and scrap it?
Yeah. So these are high stakes conversations, high stakes. We will meet with a room full of executives, top level leadership, and sometimes by day three or four that we're meeting with them, they'll look around the room and say, this person is no longer in a job. This person's no longer in a job. We've essentially decided we're not going to be about this type of role anymore, so we're going to have to let this person go, or we're going to have to migrate them into a different position. I've been called in for a public utility company where they wanted to decrease their overhead by 30%. And where does your cost structure come from? It comes from the people that you pay. And so a lot of people that we brought in to help us revise the processes, revise the structure, knew eventually that they may not have a seat at the table. So there are some, these are high stakes, high stress. People are making difficult decisions, and I help them in a methodical and a strategic, a logical way, come to choices that have real impact on their business.
Wow. I think that's something interesting that you bring up too, is that, because when I first took the class of leadership, I thought it was gonna be more of like Coach Carter kind of thing, where we just really motivate people to do well and then that's it. But it's a lot more than that. It's not just, there's a lot of integration into the system. There's a lot of things, moving parts that have to be taken care of, and it really can propel a company in a certain way. Like, it's very powerful. And that is something I didn't personally realize until that class. It was very cool. Did you find any, so maybe we can describe, we'll go into a little bit of leadership, kind of go back and forth between leadership and consulting and startups and things like that. But how would you define leadership? And I know leadership could be defined a lot of ways, but how would you personally define it?
Yeah. So there's lots of different ways to think about leadership. One is to think about it as inspirational. And I love the quote by Stephen Covey, who says, leadership is conveying the potential and worth to others until they see it themselves. So it's this idea of what you're talking about, Coach Carter, who really helps people to see, be their best selves, to raise their levels of expectation for performance, and to really develop them as individuals. You know, leaders are nothing without their followers, and so the most important thing that you can do as a leader is to develop your followers. That's how you raise the performance of your team. If you, the scientist in me, says that there are other ways to define leadership. And if you boiled the ocean of all the research that leadership is about, it's about one, creating structure. So understanding what needs to be done, organizing, creating a vision, setting a path to achieve that vision. So structuring the work. The other part of leadership is about relationships. How do you engage with other people? How do you connect with other people? How do you harness the diverse talents of a team where maybe they don't get along? Maybe there's maybe there's conflict among people. Maybe they have different motives for being there. How do you bring a diverse group of people who may not be there for the right reasons or who may not have the right skill set, who may just not get along? How do you take a group like that and transform them into a high-functioning team? And so if you think about leadership as structure and relationships, that gives you a good starting point. Obviously, there's a lot more nuance to it.
Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to make this connection in my head, and I honestly don't know the answer to this or have it fully conveyed, but how do we make the connection from leadership to a startup? And that being said, I mean, when you have a startup, you're starting from zero, right? So you may be the only employee, yeah. And then maybe you have another employee, but for a long time, there isn't really any structure. So how do you develop a startup with structure and maybe culture for those relationships, I'm not sure, to get to set yourself up, basically lay a good foundation, if that makes sense.
So I think traditionally we think about leadership as something that falls within a hierarchical structure, right? So I'm a leader if I have a formal position and there's people below me. And so thus the question, do you really need leadership if you don't have structure? I think about leadership in a very different way. Leadership is, to me, positive influence. Now, leadership can be enacted by any member in a team that doesn't have a management title. So leadership, the world is just too complex. There's too much change, and leaders don't have all the information. And so they have to rely on the leadership of those around them for them to ultimately be successful. A leader who relies too much on their own skills, knowledge, intellect, is setting themselves up for failure. Now, the best leaders understand that they're incomplete. They surround themselves with really smart people, and they allow them to lead at different times, at different points, depending on the needs of the team. And so I think, you know, under that definition of leadership is influence. Startups need leadership probably more than any organization, because there's a lot of ambiguity with startup. There's a lot of change with a startup. The leader doesn't know everything that's going on in the marketplace or have all the technical abilities to navigate product development, customer relationships. So surrounding themselves with the right people, back to this idea of creating relationships of high performing teams as part of it. The other part of the work that an entrepreneur does that's important is to create the structure. So over time, these organizations become increasingly complex and structured in their work. And so when do you put a process in place? When do you put a structure in place? What are the goals that we need to have? And ultimately, what is our purpose? You know, what's the end game that we need to accomplish? And great leaders, entrepreneurial leaders, are visionary. They create this future compelling state of what can be accomplished, what should be accomplished, and it's almost radical. And that's what really fuels them and motivates them to do some crazy things, like go into debt or, you know, operate at a loss for months on end. You know, Bill Gates didn't start off by thinking, I want to be the richest man in the world. Bill Gates started off thinking, I want to revolutionize how people interact with technology by putting a PC in every house. And at the time, it was a very radical idea. But he moved heaven and hell to make it happen. And people rallied around that vision. Great leaders have a unifying purpose that draw people to them, that motivate them, that help them overcome surmountable obstacles. Elon Musk, now he doesn't want to be one. He didn't set out to be the richest man in the world. He set out to revolutionize the energy industry. And he wants to change climate. the things that we're doing to our climate, and he wants to do that by providing different energy sources. And he's starting with cars, and he's going to build batteries that then will fuel other things. And so the important thing is that leaders have a purpose, and they surround themselves with great people that will help them to be ultimately successful. And that aligns well with the definition we've talked about of leadership.
That's a really good point, that each one of those people you named, it's true. I mean, the money wasn't the main goal. They had a purpose that was large enough and like you said, radical enough that people wanted to get behind it. Like, you get, when you think of Elon Musk, at least for I do, I almost get like invigorated just thinking like, oh yeah, like heck yeah, let's do this. Like, you know, he's gonna really, this guy's changing the world. But it all starts because of those simple or non-simple purposes. So,
and I think we don't fully appreciate that, because we think that what drives the world is incentives. Mm-hmm. Right? If I pay people enough, and as starving students, you know, we're looking forward to that paycheck, we're looking forward to that piece of equity. But if we pick something that aligns with our purpose and our end goals and our passion, those things will come. The financial rewards, the recognition will come. I'm a firm believer in that. You have to find something that you're passionate about, that a purpose that aligns with your purpose, for you to do all the hard things, to roll up your sleeves and do the nitty-gritty and put in the long hours for you to be successful. If you're just out there to get money, you know, you could do that in a lot of different ways, and ultimately you're going to find that it's not really that fulfilling at the end of the day. So find something, you know, as a form of personal leadership, my advice is to find something that you're passionate about, find something that's purposeful to you, and then find an organization where you can unleash that purpose and passion.
And that's a really good point as well. Do you think, so one of the things, like for instance, if I had a startup, one of the things I'd want was like what you said, empower people by giving them a purpose, so that they can make important decisions, and hopefully if I was a leader, help me make good decisions, because they're going to know things that I won't know, obviously, like especially if it has to do, if they're in a completely different area of work, like in tech or something, they're going to know more than I do in tech, obviously. So how do you, I think the fear though is that if you empower someone too much and let them be a leader and give them too much ground, that they'll take over your position or something, mm-hmm. or that people won't see you as competent because now this person's seems more competent. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does. And it really reflects, I think, a common mentality, which is a scarcity mentality. The more that you have, the less that I have. And I think that is, you know, a false assumption in the world, that really it's not a zero-sum game. It's a non-zero-sum game, in that the pie is not fixed, in that the more that you have, if I'm your leader and I'm working with you, that's great. The happier I should be for you. The better you perform, the better I look as a leader, the better that our company performs. And so my job, number one job, is to set you up for success. And one criteria is, if I retired today, if I left the company, sold out the company, and you were put in the role of my position, would the company be in a better position today when you take the role than it was with me yesterday? And if the answer is yes, then by my account, you've been a great leader. Right? You've helped develop that person. You've set them up for success. So I think I'd encourage us to think more in an abundance mentality. Think about how it's a win-win for all of us if people on my team are successful.
So it sounds almost more of like a, instead of a structured hierarchy, it's more of a team.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I think, you know, one of the quickest ways to undermine your authority is to say, do something because I'm a leader. That only got us so far with your parents, right? At one point in time, you started questioning your parents because they said do it, and you wanted to know. Then you quickly wanted to know why, and you wanted to share your own opinions, and you wanted those incorporated in whatever your family or what you were deciding. Same is true in work. If you rely on the hierarchy, if you're on this rigid structure of leadership, where of a team where I'm the leader, it's a command and control organization, you're not going to get as much out of your people. Over time, that will demotivate them. The best people that work in that kind of structure have kind of a low skill level and low motivation. The people that you don't want working for you. If you want to hire people that are bright, that are ambitious, that want to challenge the world, that want to do extraordinary things, then you have to be more comfortable with a more fluid team structure where sometimes they take a leadership role and they make a suggestion, they make a proposal, and you say, you know what, I had one, but yours is better than mine. And it takes a degree of humility and self-awareness for leaders to stand up and say, this is the best thing for our team, and just because I don't have the best idea, that's okay with me. You know, we're going to move forward because ultimately it's what's going to make our team most successful. And that engenders greater trust and loyalty from people on your team. Once they contribute to something, they're more likely to be motivated to make it happen. You own what you co-create. So if you can help people be a part of the co-creation process, they're more likely to drive it, to persist when challenges come, and to see it happen.
That's such a good point. I remember I was in a position where I had to train someone, and this is my first time doing it, and it felt like an important thing. And the person had a very headstrong, he was a perfect person. He's a go-getter. He wanted to get things done. He was a powerful member of the team. But I was still in that position to train him with more of like the administration and things like that and how we do things. Anyways, I remember we got to a point where we disagreed, and finally I was like, okay, well, we're going to do it this way because I'm the senior person in this and I'm the one who's supposed to make the decisions. And that was probably the worst thing that I could have said. Mm-hmm. And I after that, I never forgot it. And I always remembered, I was like, man, that just showed how weak of a leader I was at that point, because I had to revert to that, which is, in my opinion, and kind of what you said, I think, as well, is kind of a last resort. Like, you never want to get to that spot where you have to lay down the law like that.
Yeah, and it changed your relationship.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to come back from that. You know, that flexibility is another area that leaders have to be comfortable with. You know, one of my most painful moments as a consultant was butting heads with the president of a company. This was a $100 million company, and we didn't see eye to eye about the approach. And I sensed that, and he sensed that on subsequent phone calls, but it came to a head, you know, 2 days before we were supposed to meet with the team and do a restructure for his entire executive team. But I got a call from the principal of the consulting firm, and he said, look, Brett, we need to step down. We're going to have you go to the consulting session, but you're going to take notes, and we're going to have someone else come in and help. And I wasn't listening to the best ideas in the room. I wasn't being flexible. I had my train of thought of what needed to happen, and it was pretty myopic. I had my blind spot on, my blinders on. And that led me down a path to where the client essentially fired me, you know, and said, we don't want this guy helping us out because he doesn't get us. He's not open to different ideas, different approaches. And I learned from that, you know, and that was a tough pill to swallow. But that changed my approach to subsequent clients, to think about, you know, how to be more open-minded, how to be more flexible, how to reconsider my ideas in a more objective fashion. You know, rather than just taking them, for face value and moving forward with them.
Mm-hmm. So you bring up a good point as well in that, because, and this is something I've thought about, is like, obviously you want to motivate and you want to tell people good things, right? Like, I've heard there's a coach who only tells his players when they've done something right. Like, he doesn't tell them, like, oh, you did this wrong. He says, oh, great, you did this right, let me show you what you did. And he catches them on their ups, yeah, rather than their downs. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, too, there comes a point where you need to, I don't want to say discipline, but maybe correct certain behavior or attitude. And that, like, how would you go about that,
yeah,
is the question. You know, yeah, how do you maintain that, hey, let's do it, empower them, you know, make them feel like they're co-creating, they're in the team, but at the same time, like, you need to fix this,
yeah,
or something's, you know what I mean? We need to have a change.
So you need to be selective on what you pick, and you need to think about the proportion of positive versus negative feedback. And so you, if you can imagine, you know, someone who piles on negative feedback, 9 negative comments for every 1 positive comment, right? Think about the quality of relationship that's going to create. Now, if you reverse that and you had 9 positive comments for every 1 negative comment or constructive feedback, then I think you're closer to where people can where people will thrive. When people love to be affirmed, people love to get positive feedback, to understand that they're doing well, and that's a great way to push them to achieve even more. I mean, I don't think we fully appreciate that, but selectively we need to think about times when, if this is an ongoing problem, if this is a pattern of behavior that we need to intervene on, then I'm going to have a conversation with them. And because I've built this emotional bank account with them by making all these deposits, emotional deposits, by giving them compliments, affirming them, when they hear that one piece of negative feedback, look, here's what you're doing, here's what I'm seeing, and it's not working, they're not going to, or they're going to be less likely to put up a wall, to become defensive. You've developed a relationship where there's a give and take. The other thing that I would consider doing is, as a leader, asking for feedback. If you can reciprocate giving and receiving feedback, you open up the door for them to receive feedback from you when you invite feedback from them. And this is not an easy thing for leaders to do, but by simply asking them, next time you meet with someone, how am I doing as a leader? How am I doing in supporting you and helping you to be successful? And what can I do to be better at those things? And so opening the door for constructive feedback for you creates this bubble of trust where you can actually exchange feedback with each other in subsequent interactions.
Mm-hmm. So along with the feedback idea, and we've kind of gone a little bit off the questions, but so the feedback idea, I really love. I'm a big believer of that. I think the more feedback we have, the more understanding, and the more understanding, the more change we can make, is my thought process at least. But I've also run into it too when I'm in the lower position, right? And let's say I have a manager or someone above me, and if they might bring up an issue, maybe I forgot something or I didn't do something, and they feel like, I'm sloppy or I'm not paying attention or something. So then I give them my idea why that situation happened. Like, well, I was thinking this is why I made that decision, and this is what brought me to here. And then they take it back as, well, okay, we don't need excuses, we just need to do this. Whereas for me, my thought process is, I'm giving you all the ammunition by telling you my thought process. Now, like, help me either change my thought process or help me, or just let me know maybe I'm wrong. I don't know exactly what I need to do. Does that make sense?
So one of the ideas that I think is powerful to leadership and individual leadership is empathy. So put yourself in their shoes. How do they, what are they perceiving in you that would cause them to react in such a way? Well, they're perceiving you to be defensive. They're perceiving you to explain away why you didn't do what you were doing. I think in the moment when you say, I didn't do this because, you've missed a window. If you can go to them beforehand, right? So instead of waiting for a return report and accountability, go to them and say, look, I know you said I should approach it this way. How about, I've been thinking about that, and what if we tried this instead? Getting buy-in and input before that time of accountability where they're asking you, what did you do? And you're saying, I didn't do it, or I did it differently. Go up to them before the meeting to get their input. But I think the other thing that's hard to do is to really think about what is it about that feedback, even if it's just a granule of truth that I can apply and improve. How can I learn? And one of the more painful stories, I'll share another one, is when I asked my wife, my father, for her hand in marriage. And, stereotypical, ask for some time, you go up, you sit down in front of him, you get grilled with a few questions, you pour out your heart, you tell how happy you want to make this person and you want to spend the rest of your life with them. I kid you not, he looks back at me and he says, Brett, you're not good enough for her. And my heart just sank. And then he said, but no one else is. And I didn't really hear the last part. I was too busy, moving towards a fetal position where you don't come back from that. And I walked out and gave a hug to my future mother-in-law. But that was a hard piece of feedback. And I could have said, you don't know me. I could have explained a whole host of reasons why I thought I was good enough for her. I didn't do that in the moment. One, because I was just flabbergasted. I had no words. But two, I wanted to noodle on it. I wanted to think about what was it that I did? What about my behavior that led him to believe that? And how could I change that going forward? And so that became a driving force for me in our relationship, and thinking about how I could take care of her and make her happy and do all the right things. And fortunately it took a few years, right? But he considers me one of the choicest blessings in his life. We've developed a great relationship between the two of us because of what I've invested in our relationship and what I've invested in my marriage.
That's a great story. A lot of gets me scared. I haven't done that yet, so it doesn't give me too much hope.
It's unusual. Don't go in thinking the worst. You'll be great.
But okay, so we shared a lot of really great a lot of great principles, and I think ways we can get started, especially in a startup with leadership. Some core principles to build around. I want to ask you one last thing, and then we'll move on to the final questions. But I've been thinking about this as well. I've heard different ideas, but let's say we're building our team, we're building that structure, and we have a shared vision, or at least we're trying to build that shared vision, right? And now we need to build people to work around that shared vision, but as well in line with that shared vision. So the question is, how do we get them to work in line with that shared vision while also letting them do what, empowering them to do what they do best, mm-hmm. basically? Do we have them set goals that we think are aligned, or what would you say?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of important things, and it's there's a right balance between structure and autonomy, and I think we both as human beings we need both, and especially in a startup, that's a delicate balance to strike. So I think the first step is to create a shared vision. That is compelling, that's clear, that everyone can articulate. We know what the end zone looks like. We know what our ultimate goal is, and this is what we're really about. As far as creating autonomy, the best leaders that I've worked with and that I've seen are care about the end goal, care less about how it gets done. And so it's about creating an overall picture and then creating sub-goals underneath it that will aggregate into achieving your ultimate goal. And then allowing those people, so if it's over product development, here's the timing of the product, here's the types of features that we need in the product, here's the type of impact that we want the product to have, and then trusting your leader of product development to go out there and have the technical competence to be able to do those things and return and report in and to have some accountability. It doesn't mean you forget about it until it's done, but you're giving them the freedom with some guidance from time to time, because otherwise you wouldn't be doing your job, just giving them feedback on how they're progressing towards that end goal. But you're ultimately leaving the means up to them and caring more about the ends.
Is there a way to check to make sure that you're headed in the right direction, or do you just wait until the last day and say, okay, where are we at?
Yeah. So that would be, not the right way to do it, to put it lightly, because you're setting yourself up to be surprised, and nobody wants to be surprised, especially with negative results. So I think when you ask them what to do, when you say come up with the means, you're essentially putting a project proposal together. So in a project proposal, you're saying, here are the milestones, right? Here are the resources we need. Here's the timing and schedule that we anticipate. And so you have those to then have regular check-ins. So once a week, every day, depending on how complicated, depending on the pressures that are going on. But you're having regular check-ins and holding them accountable for the project plan that they created. Right? You have some input up front into what the project, it shouldn't take us 6 months. We really need to make this happen in 5 months. Now, what can you do that? Can I give you some more resources to make that possible? Sure, we can make it happen that way if you give me part-time of this individual. Well, okay, so this is your plan. Let's now have a cadence of accountability where we meet on a regular basis. You give me updates, ask for suggestions, resources, and the best project planners or the best leaders will come to their leader with questions, with solutions, and wanting to get guidance from their leader so that they can stay on the right path. So I think that to me, that blends the best of both worlds. When you actually let someone, you help them establish the ends, but you let them, for the most part, create their own project plan of how they're going to make it happen.
Okay, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. So we're at 9:40 right now. Are we good on time, or where are we?
Let's do another 5 minutes. Does
okay. Yeah. Okay. So, one last question. I apologize. This is really the last question. But I'm trying to make the most of my time with you. How do you think about what do you think about Steve Jobs' approach? Right, because Steve Jobs was known to be inconsiderate, not very flexible, almost like. I feel like Steve Jobs, besides being a visionary, is opposite of everything else mm-hmm. that we've talked about in leadership. Yeah. So what can we attribute his success to? Or is that just an anomaly, or is that like people that he worked with? I don't know if you thought about that, but I've been thinking about that a lot.
So I think there's no question that leaders can be jerks, right? That they can push and shove and be critical and be egocentric, and Steve Jobs is certainly an example of that. But I think what leveled the playing field for Steve Jobs is the visionary aspect, right? He thought about things in such radical ways, and he was willing to take immense risks that really moved him to do things that leaders in technology had never done before. There are very few people like us, like Steve Jobs, right, who have the intellect and who have the vision that he does. And so if you think about kind of a suite of skills, right, that people have that allow them to be effective leaders, vision and purpose is one of those things. If you score super high on that one, that may compensate for lower levels of skill in other areas, like the ability to have emotional intelligence, to be able to connect, to build trusting relationships with other people. If you're not as high on that, and most of us aren't, then we need to round out our suite of leadership skills by making sure that we have a greater repertoire of leadership abilities so that we can have a vision. Maybe it's not as great, but we also, in addition to that, have a great way of connecting with people, of understanding, empathizing with people. We have a great, we have high integrity. We haven't talked much about that, but that's critical for building trust in people. Why would I follow you if I don't trust you? And at the core of trust is a life filled with integrity. Do you do what you say you're going to do? Are you consistent? Do you have values, and do you keep those values? Do those values resonate with me? And so if we can build out that suite of skills and characteristics of leadership, more and more likely to be effective. I think you can always point to exceptions to the rule. And for me, Steve Jobs is an exception because he's exceptionally high on some of those dimensions and maybe much lower on others. For the rest of us, we have to work on all of them.
That makes sense. That's a good way to put it, because I was thinking about that for a while. I was like, man, I just feel like he's not the person leadership. He's not the style of leadership that I want, but he did get a lot done, and that's a good argument for why that happened. Okay, so we just have a few random questions we ask everyone. So what book or books would you recommend?
So I'd recommend reading mine. I'm writing a leadership book right now, a textbook. Actually, I don't recommend reading it. Because it's a textbook, it's sure to be pretty dry. I love a book by Ryan Quinn, who was my advisor at University of Virginia during my PhD program. It's called Lift.
Okay.
It talks about the psychological state of leadership, and you saw a lot of it in the class that I taught. But really, leadership, if we want to change our actions and we want to change the positivity of our actions, we need to change our thoughts. And we need to change how we think about things. And that has cascading influence on our behaviors in ways that we don't fully appreciate. And so it's really about simple ways in which we can elevate our thoughts, change our thoughts, and then change our behaviors. Anything by Malcolm Gladwell is great. Blink, Outliers. Adam Grant, Give and Take, is another really interesting book about how people that give more than they receive in the professional world are ultimately uber successful, and how doing that builds a successful network that ultimately pays dividends.
Awesome. I'm excited to read a couple of those. I haven't read all of those. The next one is, do you set goals? And if so, how do you go about making them and then keeping them?
So I do set goals. I've got daily goals. I've got annual goals. Probably my favorite goals are my family goals. We sit down and have like a family council from time to time. And sometimes we set a huge goal that requires a lot of work to work towards it. A few years ago, after many years, they convinced me we need a dog. And so the dog was not going to be, they didn't want just any dog. They wanted a dog from a breeder, a specific dog that was probably more than you should pay for a dog. But I said, okay, if we're going to do this, then let's set a goal for how much money we're going to save. And we're going to do that by making choices. So we may not eat out one day, or we may not go to a movie, and we'll decide to put that in. So helping my kids understand the importance of saving and trade-offs. And so socially holding each other accountable, measuring the results. We had the thermometer on the refrigerator that showed their progress so they could see and get excited, and that motivated them. And ultimately, we got King Charles Cavalier Spaniel from a breeder in Kansas, of all places. So the kids were thrilled. So from time to time, we do goals like that, but I think there's some interesting principles about how to keep and set goal and actually achieve your goals.
That's awesome. How much sleep do you usually get?
I usually get about 6.5 hours of sleep. Okay. Yeah.
It's pretty good. I'm more at 8, so yeah. Anything below that would be nice. Do you have any rituals or routines, maybe in the morning or at all throughout the day?
Yeah, so I get up about 6 or 6:15, and we sit down as a family, and we read the scriptures. We actually spend some time talking about them. And then we do this really weird thing, we do a cheer before my kids leave. And we all put our hands in the middle, and some of them are blurry-eyed, and teenagers think they're too cool to be a part of it. We put our hands in our middle, and we say, there's no quitting Crane, and be good and do good. Go Cranes. I think we do that because sports is a big part of our family. All my kids are involved in sports. But also because we want to teach them, we want a culture in our family that teaches them it's not just the end result of success, the trappings of success, but it's actually the person that you are and the people that you help. And so we stole this idea from Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, who said that all wisdom can be condensed into these few words, be good and do good.
Wow, that's really, really cool. And the last one I have is if you could have a text message show up on everyone's phone in the world, what would it say?
It would say, stop looking at your phone. So this is actually a point of debate that we've had in my family for a while. And my kids, who are teenagers and who have phones and love their social media, we've talked about how to do things, how to make choices in your life that where you are not, where technology is not the master of you, but you are the master of technology. And I worry, and I'll get on my soapbox here a little bit, about the social implications of too much screen time and how much time we spent comparing ourselves on social media, playing mindless games with our phones, how that will impact our social development, our ability to connect with people, to be leaders, to be members of productive teams, to communicate with others. And so we've done crazy things like we took a whole week where we experimented. Before you looked at your phone, you had to read something inspirational for about 5 minutes. And so one, it created a deterrent, right? You just weren't looking at your phone every few seconds to see what's going on and see if someone liked your post on Instagram, because you didn't have 5 minutes to invest in it. And then it changed where you went after you read those 5 minutes of inspirational things. You know, maybe you, for me personally, I started to listen to great scholars and people that give speeches, and inspirational speeches, learning more about leadership. And it's something that's changed slowly the pattern of behaviors in our family. But I'd say, you know, go out and talk to someone. Go out and, you know, do something. You know, build a relationship with a human being. You know, work on a skill or develop your calling in life, whatever that may be, whatever sphere of influence you find yourself in. There's so many more things that will pay dividends and returns than, you know, letting technology be your master.
Yep, I love that answer. I definitely have too much time on my phone, I think. I mean, I think everyone does, but that is, it's a hard thing to break. So that's a really cool example. Awesome, Professor Crane, thank you so much for being with us today, and I really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.